podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Jones! Bowden! He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, and we greet you with the news that Test cricket, of course, is back with England against New Zealand on Thursday at Lord's, and England have announced their team a day early, which is quite unusual, which means a debut for the Durham fast bowler Matthew Potts, who continues quite a long line actually of Durham fast bowlers making it into the England ranks. So we're going to talk about the Test team and the prospects for that first Test match with, of course, Brendan McCullum, the new head coach, and Ben Stokes, the new captain as well, beginning their partnership together. Just as a little kind of teaser, we did a podcast last week recapping the great 2009 Ashes tail end partnership between Monty Panesar and Jimmy Anderson. Here's just a little section of that from last week.
Little tries again, bowls to Collingwood outside the off stump, he goes for it, oh it's caught at backward point in the gully region. Australia absolutely delighted. Is that the wicket that sets them on the path to victory? It was taken at the second attempt by Hussey. Collingwood looking to score, again it was a ball he could have left, he pushed at it and it was in the air, he could not control it. And England are 233 for 9. They are 6 runs behind.
Despair for Paul Collingwood. What a valiant effort. What a doughty performance. Nearly 6 hours at the crease. Siddle ecstatic having taken that wicket. You're quite right, Simon. He could have left it. But runs, as I said, are still important. And Collingwood has to depart. 74 from 245 balls. Almost 6 hours, as I said, at the crease. But the key thing is, it now exposes Monty Panesar to these Australian bowlers with at least 11 overs remaining.
We kind of felt like Collie's going to, you know, get us through this and we'll end up maybe, you know, drawing the match. But even then, it was very tense. Everyone just sitting on their own seats. You know, when things are going well in the dressing room, you tend to sit on the seat that you're supposed to sit and then not move. So Collie was batting so well. We were all just in our own seats and no one moved the whole session until he was batting. But once number 9 is in, I'll have all my kit on because there's been often we've had, you know, a complete carnage and, you know, loads of wickets fall and then next I'm in. So I'm always ready to go. And it's that sort of hope when everyone looks at me thinking, gosh, Monty's going out to bat, like there's no hope here, is there?
Hope you enjoyed that podcast. And if you haven't heard it, you can go back and listen to it by going back on our podcast list. It was, of course, the classic 11-over last wicket stand between Monty and Jimmy, which allowed England to survive that test and then, of course, go on to win the Ashes in 2009. This is 2022 and England are in, well, Simon, a bit of a plight, you'd say, in a way, having won only one of the last 17 tests. But a new broom has come in. What do you think?
Well, a new broom has come in, but not necessarily in the team, although I have to note there are 4 changes from England's last Test match, although some familiar faces are back. Ollie Pope is back, Stuart Broad is back, and Jimmy Anderson, 13 years after helping England block out for that draw in Cardiff, he's still there. He's 40 this summer. Stuart Broad is, I think, 36 this summer. And the old firm are back in. Stuart Broad saying yesterday that he's focusing on just concentrating his energy on the match in front of him. He's not trying to hold his body back or manage his body to get through a whole series. He's going to go for it in this Lord's Test match. That's the way to go. And that's what he's been working on. And also talking about striving for wickets. Sometimes England have been accused of bowling dry, if you like, you know, and trying to bottle up the runs. Brendan McCullum's theme for the team seems to be, yeah, go for it. Let's strive for wickets. I was actually interested in listening to Brendan McCullum earlier this week, and he was talking about his philosophy. He was asked to sum it up, and he said, well, I'll try to simplify it. It's take wickets with the ball. Well, you think, well, that's pretty obvious. That's what you've got to do. But actually, I think it is be a bit more positive with the ball, isn't it? I think that's the message you're trying to get across. Absorb pressure with the bat. and be able to identify times to put pressure back on the opposition and be brave enough to do so. So there's a bowling one, a batting one, fielding one. Chase the ball hard to the boundary, which suggests you're going to get smacked to the boundary quite a lot. That might well happen. And give to the team. So those are four pillars, if you like. I mean, they're not sort of revelatory particularly, are they? But they're quite a sort of simple philosophy. And also, I think if you come out and make a bold statement about how you're going to play, right, we're going to be ultra attacking, then that is sort of hangs around your neck, doesn't it, for your whole time in office almost. And those statements he's made, they are quite simple and they're almost incontrovertible in a way.
I think it's dangerous to make too many bold statements, actually, when you're taking over as coach. And actually, yeah, the key to Test cricket and probably to coaching a Test team as well is to get players to just recognise moments when they need to take the initiative themselves, to be better at A, recognising the moment, and B, then taking hold of that moment and doing the best thing for the team as a result. And so, that is about knowing what, it's seeming around early on the first morning, pitch it up a bit more. Don't hang your length back and try to dry up the runs. Go for wickets. It means if the ball is seeming around when you're batting, be a bit more selective. Just don't play the ball outside off stump. Don't go for the big drives. Wait until the conditions are a bit easier and then you can play your natural game. It's about recognising those moments when you've got to adjust, you've got to adapt. And that's, I think, the beauty of Test cricket. I think back to last summer, for instance, Rohit Sharma batting at Lord's, seeming all over the place. The bowling was superb. He batted absolutely brilliantly, and he'd just come off playing in the IPL, woofing the ball over the top and smacking it on the up and all that. He left probably 70% of the deliveries that were bowled at him in that Lord's morning. He played under his nose. He defended with soft hands. He didn't try and drive the ball. And he made a brilliant 80. And, I mean, KL Rahul in the end got 100. But the batting of Rohit Sharma, the adaptability and the intelligence that he showed there, that's what England need.
Yeah, and that's going to be focused, isn't there, on Zach Crawley in the next few weeks, whether he is able to play in that sort of more measured way or more calculating way. I mean, a lot of people say, you don't get anything in life unless you're prepared to take a risk. And that's sort of true to some extent, but it's actually what it really is. If you boil it down a bit more, I don't think you get anywhere in life unless you take a risk at the right time. Because if you take a risk at the wrong time, then it will fail. So it's all about that calculated risk. And that sounds really obvious, but I think it's not just about risk taking. I think a lot of people look at Brendan McCullum and think England are going to be, ultra aggressive because that's the way he played his, Test cricket and one day international cricket as well. But actually, I think he's talked about being slightly freer, hasn't he? I think that's the emphasis. Be slightly freer than they have been. But, for Crawley, it's not go out there and, try and score 100 before lunch. I mean, it'd be fun if he did. I mean, if the ball's there to hit, yeah, score 100 before lunch. But so there's the challenge, I think, for a player like Zach Crawley for the next a few weeks. And clearly they like him. Brendan McCullum was talking him up, actually, saying, he's a really talented player, and we've all seen that flicker of his talent. But without that discipline as well, without that ability to leave that the Rohit Sharma leave, then it'll all come undone, because we've said, yeah, it many times, high scores, lots of low scores, high score, lots of low scores, in fact a lot more low scores than many high scores, really.
But both Crawley and Ollie Pope, of course, has been pivoted in at number three. I would recommend they watch that Rohit Sharma innings at Lord's. It's the same ground that they're playing at Thursday morning or whenever they bat. And it will probably be similar conditions, early summer. It's been raining a little bit the last few days. It might well be cloudy. You've got Duke's balls, you've got bowlers who are masterly at making it nip around the New Zealanders. So that Rohit Sharma, it's an absolute masterclass in how to open the batting in a Test match at Lord's. I'd recommend any England batsman should watch it.
Of course, he also produced that amazing innings at the Oval as well, which helped India go 2-1 up in the Test series. He played brilliantly under pressure in the second innings. Yeah, high class batting from Rohit Sharma last summer. Just talking about, it is a new era, isn't it? And there are lots of changes, but those changes, they're not exclusively off the field, but you sort of feel they largely are. You've got a new managing director, new coach, new captain. There's going to be a new selectorial panel. There's going to be a new chief executive eventually. Claire Connors, the interim chief executive at the moment. Just in terms of looking at the personnel playing in this test match, players who didn't play, say, in the Ashes, well, you have got one in Alex Lees, haven't you? That's three Durham players, actually, in this England side. So you've got a Durham captain and two other Durham players. Ben Foulkes is another, and Matthew Potts. So three changes from the Ashes. So it's not a radical overhaul, is it? And you've got Anderson and Broad coming back into the side. You know, I think they just prefer Pope to Lawrence as well. Pope did play some part in the Ashes series. So it's not a staggeringly overhaul England side, is it? It's actually a reasonable amount of continuity on the pitch. I think most of the change really has come off the pitch or sort of in the administrative stroke coaching side of things.
Often there is not much difference between a side which is bottom of the table and one that's near the top of the table. It's not a question of changing everybody. It often is just a couple of changes of personnel, a little bit of tinkering of method or adaptability or approach or whatever. But you can often find, and actually, if you look at that England one-day side that went from absolute zeros to heroes in a couple of years, in 2015 to sort of 2017, there weren't that many changes. There was a few, you know, Ian Bell and Anderson and people like that went out, and one or two new names came in. But actually, the core of that team in the 2015 World Cup was quite similar to the one in 2019. They brought back Adil Rashid, and you know they tinkered with it rather than a total overhaul. And this is what England are doing now. And you know, I can see with someone like Pope, he's got the class, he's got the quality. He's a little bit better a player than Dan Lawrence, if we're honest. He's got more long range ability. I think he can play a big innings. Lawrence is a bit of a dasher. He's somebody who can, you know, certainly change a game, and he's played some pretty good innings for England. But you feel Pope is a guy who can bat a long time. He can bat a whole day, and he can adapt his game. He can play, you know, the sort of defensive style initially. He can expand later. He can bat with the tail. He did that brilliantly in South Africa. So I like the way they've invested some faith in Pope. It's going to be hard batting at number three, but it's hard whoever does it.
Yeah. Just on the comparison of, you know, where we are now and how England tried to reset in 2015, the so-called white ball reset, and how much change they came up with. I've actually been having a look at that in some detail because I was thinking about this. I heard the comment the other night that it didn't happen overnight for England's white ball side in 2015. I would slightly disagree with that. I think it did sort of happen a bit overnight in a strange way. And that the reason for that was because they had the players to make it happen and they brought them in. And actually, just looking at, I did a comparison between the team that lost against Bangladesh in the World Cup and the team that played against New Zealand in the first match in England that summer. And actually, it's easy to forget, of course, Ben Stokes wasn't at the 2015 World Cup. He came straight back in. Jason Roy came into the side. Plunkett came into the side as well. He hadn't played for 4 years for England. Rashid, you mentioned. Billings came in and made his debut against New Zealand. So there was a bit of change. There was some continuity, you're right. Hales, Root, Morgan, Butler and Jordan all played against Bangladesh. And then they all played in that match against New Zealand as well. I remember when England made 400 and they just went for it. So there was, I think there was a sort of immediate change. And they did change the side a bit, although some of them were really logical, I think, you know, bringing Stokes back in. But I can remember why Ben Stokes didn't go to the 2015 World Cup, because he was in dreadful form in the lead-up. I mean, there was some logic to it,
yeah.
Even though you think, actually, probably it would have been better to have him there. So, yeah, and I think it did happen overnight. Not overnight, but it happened quite quickly for England in 2015, because they did have the personnel. And my one concern...
It was more about attitude as well.
Yeah,
sorry.
It was.
It was an attitude thing as much as it was about a personnel thing.
Well,
really.
Yes, it was. I agree. I think you have to have the players to sort of put that into practice as well. And I think they did have those sorts of players. This time, I'm not totally convinced that they have the players. I think it could be a slow process. You know, it could be a step forward, two steps back, two steps forward, one step back. You know, there might be some more up and down times to come. They've got some difficult test series coming up this summer, and perhaps not quite as tough as what's going to come up after that. Really, Pakistan away, really difficult series. New Zealand away, difficult series, and then the Ashes next summer. But let's look not too far ahead. Okay, so it's a new era for English cricket, or roughly speaking, it's a new era. There are quite a lot of similar players in the side, as we've mentioned already. Here's a question for you, Yoz. When were England this bad in the past?
1989, they picked 29 players in the Ashes and lost 4-0. I think probably then there was so much indecision. There was also a lot of injuries, funnily enough, then as well. A lot of bowlers were injured, and that's why they had to pick so many. And of course, now they've got an incredible number of injuries. I mean, you know, if England didn't have all those injuries, especially to the bowlers, they wouldn't be that bad, probably. You know, if you had Archer and you had Wood and Ollie Robinson, maybe Chris Wokes, I mean, that's a pretty good side. And actually, one of the things that worries me about this team is tail enders. You know, who's going to bat at number eight? Is it going to be Stuart Broad? Is it going to be Matthew Potts? I mean, it's a long tail. And I always worry about that in England, especially because you can lose early wickets. Cloud comes over at Lords, a ball nips around, you lose three or four quick wickets. So suddenly, tail end runs, you know, people bat it who can bat at 7, 8, 9 are really important. You know, you can add, when the conditions ease and the ball gets a bit softer, you can add another 120, 130 runs there. And I'm not sure England have the capability to do that.
Yeah, you make a very good point about who is going to bat there. Broad, Potts, Leach at eight. It's going to be one of those batting at eight. Now, don't dodge the question anyway. And actually, you haven't. You've actually got it spot on about when England were last this bad, because in the late 80s, England had one win in 25 test matches. Between the loss in Sydney in the 1986-87 Ashes series, remember that? Peter Hu?
Yeah, I was there.
Peter Taylor coming in and wrecking England, Mike Gatting's side after they dominated the whole series. They won the series, but they lost the last test match. And then the draw at the Oval in the 1989 Ashes, England had one win in 25 test matches. Admittedly, there were 13 draws in there and 11 defeats. And they won the test match against Sri Lanka at Lords. Now, I've got a couple of other dodgy periods for English cricket.
I think it was that period when they had about five captains as well, because Gat handed the captaincy to Gower. Then Gower took over for a bit. And then there was about four captains in that West Indies series in 1988.
Yeah,
so, you know,
right.
It was all, yeah. I mean, selection was a nightmare around that time.
Yes, it was. There were four captains in the summer. John Embry and Chris Cowdery were two of the others. Graham Gooch came in at the end of the series as well. Yeah, and they ended that terrible run of one win in 25 matches by going to the West Indies and winning amazingly by 9 wickets in Jamaica against, you know, a very good West Indies side. It was an incredible victory, and they ended that really poor run. Anyway, before we go on, I just want to pick up something you said about, you know, England got a good attack if that some of those players you mentioned are fit. And I agree with that. What I would say to you, though, Yoz, is that in Australia last winter, England had James Anderson, they had Stuart Broad, they had Ollie Robinson, and they had Chris Wokes. OK, they didn't have Jofra Archer, they had Mark Wood as well. What was the result of the series? Australia 4, England 0. The point I'm making is that, OK, on paper it looks, you know, quite a good attack and quite a good side, but it was pretty ineffective, or quite ineffective.
Well, I'd have to counter by saying it doesn't matter what bowlers you've got. If you keep getting bowled out for under 200, you know, you can have, you know, Superman bowling for you. You're not going to win many tests.
OK, well, you bowl the other opposition out for 200 as well then.
Well, but not if they're quite a good side. It's not easy, is it?
OK, that's what I'm saying. OK, this is my point, is that they're quite a good side. Yeah, they're quite a good side. In England, not on that level, even with some of those players that you mentioned, and they are good cricketers, of course they are. And Jofra Archer might have made a bigger difference, but you know, Australia were able to knock it over England, but England were not able to knock over Australia for a low enough score to keep them in the series consistently. Anyway, that's the only thing I would say about England's resources. Yeah, they have got lots of resources, and they are decent bowlers. They are, but when push comes to shove in tough Ashes series, are they quite good enough? And I think we've discovered that they're not. So this is why I think it's going to take a bit of a time. And I think you've identified England's lower order batting as a potential problem area. And I just wonder about their attack as well, their ability, you know, in the next year or so to take 20 wickets consistently, which might put some pressure on the batting as well. Anyway, just a couple of other dodgy periods. We mentioned that the one in 17 and the one in 25 back in the late 80s. Incredibly, in the early 90s, so not long after, this really was a bit of a low point for English cricket. in the early 90s, England had 13 defeats in 17 matches. 13 test defeats in 17 matches in 92 to 93, 4. So, you know, that wasn't a great period either. They had a couple of victories. And then there was late 70s, one win in 19 matches. That was from the first test in 1979 up until Headingley, just before Headingley 1981. So that period was another real low point. So it's not as bad now as it was then, but it's as bad now as it's been for about, well, close on 30 years, in terms, statistically anyway, in terms of one win in 17.
I mean, you know, the 89, 90, 91 period was a tough period for Test cricket for anybody other than the West Indies or Australia. West Indies were obviously still dominant, and then the Australians, sort of late, early 90s, came through with Warne and McGrath and all those great players. So those were the two dominant sides, and it's forgivable in a way that England didn't have a great period. I mean, now there isn't really a totally dominant side in Test cricket, not in the same way as there was in with either the West Indies in the 80s or the Australians in the 90s. So there's less excuse, really, for England to be as poor as they are. And you know, one other area that we must highlight is the opening pair. You do need a good opening pair with the bat. And England still haven't found that. And they've been tinkering around for, you know, 3 or 4 years since Alistair Cook retired. They still haven't really found the right combination. Alex Lees and Zach Crawley are the men in occupation, hopefully, for this series anyway. I'm not convinced that they are going to be the best solution. But when you talk about bowlers' effectiveness, they rely, and this sounds a bit counterintuitive, on opening batsmen being successful, because one, it gives the team a foundation to build a good score, and two, it gives the bowlers some time off. And if the bowlers are never getting any time off because you're getting bowled out in 50 overs because the opening pair are not able to see off the new ball and everyone else falls over, then it's very hard for those opening bowlers to do their job and be at their most effective. So to me, the opening pair with the bat are fundamental to the team.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. It is really important. And I've written down, what do England need? And I've come up with three things, and they are top order runs, spinners who can win matches, brackets, overseas, and a pace attack with a cutting edge on good pitches. I think those are the three areas for England. And probably in Australia, they were found wanting in all three of those departments. And they were probably found wanting in those departments, largely speaking, in India as well, when they went to India last year on the tour there, and possibly against India as well last summer. I think, you know, you think of the Oval, a cutting edge on good pitches. I mean, Craig Overton played in that test match at the Oval, and, you know, Rohit Sharma made that brilliant 100, and England was sort of worn down on a good pitch, and then India were able to apply pressure on the final day. And, it happened with New Zealand a bit last summer as well, especially winning that Edgbaston test match in New Zealand last summer. So, yeah, the big challenge ahead for England to find the right combination. I think there will be a bit of a lift. You'd expect so, wouldn't you? And I think it's good as well. You probably agree with this. I think it's good that they've gone with Potts. If they'd gone with Craig Overton, it would just look a bit same old.
I completely agree with you. And I really like the look of Potts, actually. I'm encouraged by him. It's early days. It's his first test. He'll be nervous. He's never played at Lord's, certainly not in a 4-day game, 5-day game. And, it's a difficult place to start, but it's also a very exciting place to start. He looked good in the nets. He's certainly posed problems to the England top order players. And you feel he does bowl that heavy ball. He's aggressive. And he's interesting. He's, in quite a line, as I mentioned at the start, of Durham fast bowlers coming through to play for England. Started with Simon Brown, who only played once or twice, I think. And he was my early colleague at Durham, and he was a fine left arm bowler who probably wasn't quite good enough for Test cricket but did his best. Steve Harmison was the first really serious fast bowler from Durham who made big strides in Test cricket. And then actually you've got a couple of others. You've got Liam Plunkett, who came through. You've got Graham Onions, of course. Stokes himself, if you class him as a fast bowler. Mark Wood. And interestingly, Wood and Potts are both quite similar in a couple of ways. One, in that they come from Durham, but secondly, they both sort of started more as batsmen, actually, and really came through as bowlers in their late teens, 18, 19, 20, where their body kind of got a bit stronger and they got the confidence to bowl a bit quicker. And I think that's a key point for bowlers. Actually, thinking back to Andrew Flintoff's career, you know, when he was 18, 19, he was probably more of a batsman who bowled goodish medium pace. But it was kind of as his body filled out and he got more confidence, he suddenly found this extra gear with his bowling and it became, you know, a seriously fast bowler. And I like the progression of Potts that, of course, Stuart Broad, actually, that happened to as well in a way. He was a batsman at school and then gradually his bowling developed. And I like the look at Potts because I think he can bat as well. He's clearly had a formative time as a batsman and he's keen to extend and develop his batting. And England could really do with someone, you know, at number eight. If Chris Wokes is not going to recover and, you know, perhaps he's on the way out, maybe, you know, Potts could be that perfect replacement. And, you know, Wokes has been a tremendous asset to England at home, both with bat and ball. And we could well do with someone like him to sort of see us through the next few years.
Yeah, Chris Wokes' figures at home are superb, absolutely remarkable. Just on Potts, I had a quick look. He has been batting at nine for Durham. So is he going to bat eight for England after batting nine for Durham? He's got a first-class batting average of 17.19, a higher score of 81. But what is eye-catching for England? He's taken 35 wickets at 18.57 this summer, which is excellent. And you're right, he is a northeast lad. He was another one from Sunderland, and he's 23 years of age. And yeah, it's always exciting, isn't it? I think when you see a new young cricketer come on the scene, we don't quite know how good he is going to be. Mark Wood, heard Mark Wood talking the other day, saying, you know, he's very willing to learn. He's sort of very adaptable. He'll give it a go. And he's not quite come from nowhere, but if you'd said a year ago, oh yeah, Matthew Potts will be playing in the first test against New Zealand, I think there would have been a few people first up saying who, but there we go. He's got his chance, hasn't he, tomorrow, and he's nipped ahead of Craig Overton, who actually has had a good start to the season as well, as he often does. I remember Stephen Finn this time last year saying who's been the best bowler in the country. You know, the word is it's Craig Overton, but he's never quite been able to get that nip and venom into his bowling in Test match cricket as he has in county cricket. He's only played in one winning side out of eight Test matches so far, Headingley last year, when actually he did bowl very well in against that top class Indian batting lineup.
We haven't talked about the New Zealanders much, have we? It's easy to sort of assume that as World Test champions, they're going to be a demanding team. And of course, they always are. But they've got a few problems of their own. They haven't had the greatest few Test matches since winning that World Test Championship match in Southampton last year. Kane Williamson hasn't been great. He didn't have a particularly successful IPL. He's coming straight from the IPL, which of course Johnny Bairstow also is. They lost to the English Counties 11, got bowled out by Jamie Poulter. Well, that's happened a few times to counties to touring teams over the last two or three years. And they've got a few issues of their own, I suppose. I guess Trent Bolt won't play, having just come from the IPL final, which, of course, the Rajasthan Royals lost. But they've still got good bowlers. They've still got Kyle Jameson. They've still got Neil Wagner. They've still got, of course, Tim Southee, Matt Henry. They've got a decent bowling unit. I just wonder whether their batsmen will be quite kind of in tune this early, having had only one fairly disappointing warm-up game.
Yeah, they just seem to find a way though, New Zealand, don't they? But you're right, they haven't been in superb form since they won the World Test Championship. They only played six Test matches. They lost a series in India, which India controlled both the games. They couldn't get over the line in one of them.
They'll probably miss Ross Taylor, actually, won't they?
Yeah, Ross Taylor's obviously retired. They lost, I mean, incredibly. I mean, it seems incredible to me that they lost the Test match at home to Bangladesh in the New Zealand winter. They lost by eight wickets, or they did come back and win the next game by an innings and 117 runs. So that was one all. And then against South Africa as well, they lost a Test match at home to South Africa. They lost the game by 198 runs after winning the other game by innings and 276. So one all, and nil one their test results so far, and they are a slightly changed team. No BJ Watling, of course, as well, who was a stalwart behind the stumps because he retired after the World Test Championship final. So it is a slightly changed side, but it is, they have got a good bowling attack. Not the most flamboyant batting side, but we saw last year, didn't we, Devon Conway with that debut 100 or double 100 at Lords in the first test match. I mean, they seem to find a way with that batting order. One thing that struck me about them, actually, is the ages of the players. They're very experienced cricketers. They've got a lot of cricketers in that sort of 30 age bracket, not many in the sort of 23, 24. You look at England, you know, they've got young players, Pope and Crawley and Potts, you know, all young cricketers. But New Zealand, generally speaking, got quite experienced sort of teak tough, yeah, so hardened cricketers.
I wonder if that's also partly to do with the fact that they don't play as much cricket in New Zealand, both first class and also tests. So you have the chance of having a longer career in a way. I mean, it's undoubtedly the case. Someone like Joe Root, Josh Butler, Ben Stokes, well, although Stokes has had a bit of time off, obviously, but those guys just they play more than anyone else in the world. I know Butler's not in the test side now, but if you look at it annually, which players play the most, it's generally people from England. And the New Zealanders, some of those players are, you know, you're right, probably in their late 20s, early 30s, haven't played that many tests. So they're probably still quite fresh, but have enough experience and ages on their side in terms of knowledge of the game without it actually having worn them down.
Yeah, it could well be that. But yeah, it's notable, actually. They're all about the same age. I could go through them, but I'm not going to because that's probably quite boring. But they are in that sort of 30 age bracket. Even someone like Blundell, who's the replacement wicketkeeper for BJ Watling, is 31. He's played, you know, 17 test matches, and you know he's sort of come in and taken the gloves from Watling. So he's 31. I was thinking of him when I'll just have a look at the age of the side. I imagine he'd be 25 or something like that. I don't know. It's just a thought I had in my mind. I mean, a young player often takes over from an older player, but actually another sort of quite experienced first class cricketer. But led by Kane Williamson, he was out for a duck. He was drafted into that Counties match the other day and got a naught after quite a poor time at the IPL. It's a very different form of the game, of course, but it is about confidence, isn't it? But he's got all that experience. I mean, his record is amazing. 86 test matches, batting average of 53.47. So what can we expect then in the next month? Or should we not look ahead? I think this is the new mantra, isn't it? Just look at a game at a time.
Brendan McCullum's philosophy is almost, if I can paraphrase, imagine you're going to live forever, but live for the day, as if you're going to die tomorrow sort of thing. I haven't quite got it right, but what he's saying is go for it, really. You know, be positive, be energetic, be enthusiastic, and don't sort of try and hold something back for the future. Imagine it, you can carry on, but, you know, live for each day, really. And it's going to be interesting. Both sides with quite a few changes and a completely new opportunity. A new sort of World Test Championship is kind of unfolding. So although England are bottom, well, they can't get any worse, can they? That's one thing. I think I'm excited by the combination of Stokes and McCullum at the top. Root at number four, brilliant player. Anderson and Broad coming back. Obviously, this is going to be their swan song, I guess. Pope at number three. Lots of interesting challenges for England. And I think they'll make a good fist of it, actually. I just worry about the opening pair more than anything. But hopefully they'll come good.
What will it look like then, do you think, Yoz? I mean, in practical terms, what will this new, in inverted commas, England team or system or setup look like on the field? Sounds like they're going to chase the ball hard to the boundary. That's one thing that's going to happen. One thing to note.
Well, I mean, if they live in Stokes's sort of idea, his concept of cricket, it's going to be entertaining and positive, but hopefully smart as well. That's what we really want. And I guess if you look back to, let's say, the World Cup final 2019, that last ball of the actual match before the Super Over, what did Stokes do? He tried to knock it for two and he narrowly failed. It wasn't his fault, really. But so even though Stokes played a dramatic innings and obviously managed to get 15 off that final over to win. At the same time, he played it in a very calculated way. And I think you can see from Stokes' evolution that he is someone who will always back himself. And, you know, he's got that sort of warrior-like spirit. But he's got some smartness and intelligence, cricket intelligence, to go with it. And hopefully that's what will be reflected in England's performance.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, about the World Cup final. Because actually that ball from Trent Bolt, he could have smacked into the main stand or into the nursery ground or whatever, because it was a sort of lowish full toss. And what he did was he offered the full face of the bat to make sure he at least got it down the ground for one, so they got the super over. Yeah, it's an interesting point. And also Stokes at six as well. Will that free him up a bit more? One thing we've seen with Ben Stokes over the last couple of years is he's tried to play in a far more restrained, responsible way. I wonder whether we are going to see a more, not right from the start, but just a more positive, more attacking mindset with his batting.
Yeah, in fact, of course, we mentioned the 2015 series before, talking more about one-day cricket, but actually, what really got England going in 2015 was that test match at Lord's against New Zealand when they were something like 20 for 3 or 30 for 4 or something. And Stokes and Root got together and turned the game round. And Stokes played a positive innings. I think he got 96 and Root got 100. And it was just a superb partnership of enterprise and skill and recognition of key moments. And just a kind of positive ethos, but within a kind of calculated risk nature, if you like. And Stokes played that innings really set the tone for England's reinvention as a one-day side, even though it was in a test match.
Yeah, it was an incredible game of cricket, that. Root got 98, Stokes 92. England were 30 for 4, made 389. But then New Zealand came out and made 523. So that, you know, they were controlling the game, but Cook got 100. Then Stokes made 101 off 92 balls. You know, some dramatic stroke play, 15 fours and 3 sixes.
And I think he batted at six there, didn't he? Is that right?
He batted 2, 4. Yes, he did. He batted at six. Joss Butler was at 7. Root actually was at 5. It was Lythe, Cook, Balance, Bell, Root, Stokes, Butler, Moeen Ali, Broad, Wood, Anderson. That was England's side in that match. And New Zealand's target was 345 to win the game, and England bowled them out for 220. I mean, it's an incredible test match. Actually, it's one of the top test matches, I think, of recent years in this country. And New Zealand's record, actually, at Lord's, is not very good, is it? They've only won once. That was back in 1999, when they bowled England out on a very grey morning. It was amazing bowling conditions. They took advantage of that, but that is their only test match win at Lord's. So we'll see how it goes. I think we're all interested, aren't we? Yeah. Some people, I think, are very optimistic about, you know, it's going to be so much better. I think I would advise, as I probably always do, a little bit of caution. I think, you know, there are going to be some ups and downs, and there's some, you know, big tests ahead. And I do slightly worry about England's ability to consistently take 20 wickets, especially if they're not going to get some of these bowlers fit, because they're going to have to help out some of the bowlers that are already in the team and that top order as well.
Listen, enough of this speculation. Let's just say that I'm sure England will be better than they were when they played New Zealand this time last year and refused to chase a very tantalising target that Kane Williamson set and then paid for it by losing the second test match. England will be much more enterprising and positive than that. And hopefully this podcast is a selling point for this first test, which is important because we understand that not that many tickets have been sold for this test match at Lord's, maybe because they're overpriced. Lots of people saying 160 quid for a ticket for a test match against, with a side that are bottom of the World Test Championship, and obviously the Queen's Jubilee going on and all that. And by the way, good luck to my brother-in-law, who is the pageant master for this weekend. He's organised the whole thing on Sunday afternoon. That's actually where I'm going rather than Lord's. But anyway, I'll be at the test match.
Let's get this right. A member of the Hughes family has organised the Queen's pageant.
That is true.
What could possibly go wrong? Well, at least it's not you, Yoz.
Well, thank
anyway.
God. And he's actually not a Hughes. He's an Evans.
Okay.
He's Adrian Evans. So he's my brother-in-law. Right. He's my sister's husband. So,
oh, your brother. Oh, right.
So,
okay,
you know,
right,
hopefully they'll be all will be very good and in order, I'm sure. But please get down to Lourdes, because maybe they'll just, maybe we can persuade the MCC to drop the ticket prices a bit, because it does seem as if it's priced a few people out, actually, with the travel involved and, you know, buying more than one ticket and so on. It's becoming quite an expensive business attending a test match at Lourdes. We want as many people as possible to go, don't we?
Yeah, we do, absolutely. I think Leicestershire have dropped their blast prices. I took my daughter to the Oval last night to watch Surrey against Gloucestershire in the T20 blast, and remarkably, she got in for £1. But I think one of the issues is, isn't it, that it's not easy for youngsters to get in at Lourdes for lower prices. There are only a certain number of lower price tickets, and it may well be that they've all gone. I think that's perhaps one of the issues. Anyway, obviously pricing is going to need to be looked at if the grounds are not full over the summer. But yeah, you want as big a crowd as possible. I think there'll still be, there'll still be quite big crowds, but not the sellouts that Lourdes, I think, feels it sort of justifies as a sort of big venue, major venue in world cricket. But perhaps that's to do with, their factors. I mean, England not been very good, have they, recently? I think there is an interest around how England going to get on with a new captain, new coach, etc. And perhaps, one or two new players with Potts making his debut. I think a debutant always captures the imagination. See how he goes. Wish him all the best.
Yeah, okay, so good luck to Matthew Potts. So that's it for today for our preview, which has been a little bit longer than we perhaps expected. But anyway, we're going to be producing a podcast after each day of this test series, England against New Zealand, starting tomorrow, Thursday. We'll be with you as soon as we can get together after the end of play and do a review of the day's play. So we look forward to being with you then. And by the way, I should also mention my new podcast, The Barest of Margins, which looks at the marginal gains achieved by athletes through science, through technology, through innovation. And the most recent episode is an interview with Stephen Scullion, the Irish Olympic marathon runner, about discipline in training. There's also an interview with John Gloucester, the trainer of the Bridlestone Royals in the IPL, and the importance of sleep in a sports player's preparation. So check that out, the Barest of Margins podcast. In the meantime, thanks for listening.
Podcast Network.